Their mouths were open, their breath was indrawn for the last exultant yell. And then the interview happened. Far into this afternoon of casual gabbing, historians would look back later at all this. Coming up from the choppy waters of heady discourse with a journalistic precedent to end all journalistic precedents. The subject was Will the Thrill Leech, a dashing young blogger of the Nick Denton School, drinking down a cold beer on a rainy afternoon because, hell, it was a vaguely dangerous thing to do. He was a sports polemicist who fanned the flames of discontent until they burned brighter than a boss relief by Giovanni Battista Maney. This was their conversation. This was journalism.
All right, so I am here with Will Leech, who is the author, most recently, of God Saves the Fan. Will, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm in a restaurant where it's playing Van Halen right now, yes. So I'm in a very happy place.
Yes, Van Halen is an inspirational force, I suppose. To sports, would you say?
Van Halen is an inspirational force to everything.
Well, no, I mean, actually, now that we're on the subject, I kind of want to ask you about the relation of, like, sort of cock rock and hard rock to sports. I mean, there seems to be a lot of that.
It's funny.
You didn't write about that in the book.
I didn't, though. I think that seems like something that Chuck Klosterman would probably be able to handle pretty well. But I think that I like the idea. Certainly, it seems like the type that kind of music works out very well at hockey arenas. It seems like the things they play in between the stoppages in play, those inevitably playing music very loud on those. So
but they always
like it would work.
They always play Danger Zone at football games. Yeah. They still do that, and I don't get that. That song has no expiration date, I think.
Danger Zone?
Danger Zone.
What says football better than Kenny Loggins?
Exactly. Well, first off, let's kind of talk about the basic premise of your book, which is that essentially sports journalism is currently corrupt.
Broken.
And that essentially those who toil in sports journalism are beholden to special interests, or rather the interests of the NFL, the baseball league, everything. So I must ask you, and that the fan is actually the salvation, the saving grace of this. So I have to ask you also, because you also say in the last chapter that pretty much anybody can be a sports blogger. Well, what is the purpose then, maybe, of sports journalism?
It's funny because I think it's all kind of set up. The way that a lot of sports journalism is set up now is still, it's kind of archaic. It's kind of set from the way it was back in the days when literally the only way you could find out what happened from the game the night before is by someone physically sending someone there. Yeah. Now, obviously, that's not how people consume sports anymore, but it's still kind of caught up in this idea, that idea, which I think is just frankly through inertia. So I think kind of what's happened is, because of that, there's kind of this tight circle of people who work in sports, whether you're an athlete or you work for the team or you're a media person and so on. They all just are part of the sports industrial complex. And then
the sports industrial complex?
Exactly. Sounds good, right? Someone said that the other day. I kind of like the way it sounded.
Okay.
I feel like a presidential candidate sometimes. Like, oh, I like that line. I'll grab that. Just words.
Just don't be accused of plagiarism.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just words. I think that because of that, a lot of times there's not a lot of actual interaction with real fans. I think this is why you often see, anytime you ever see a fan portrayed through any ad or portrayed by most media people, I think they're seen as like these fat, boorish, screaming, with the words ESPN across their chest or so on. I'm not that sure. I think the average fan is they're professional people. They're normal people like everybody else. I think because of that, they a lot of times have a better perspective on the games than the people that work, that often work in the world of sports. Because, if you work in sports, you tend to think that sports is more important than it actually is. And so because of that, you do kind of lose. That's why a lot of times in sports, everything's portrayed as some sort of morality tale or some sort of, and I'm not sure that's how people interact with sports. I think people kind of duck in, enjoy the games, and then duck back to their lives. And so one of the nice things about about sports blogs, the kind of movement that's happened, and I hesitate to call it a movement, but one of the nice things about it is that there are more voices. Like, but there used to be, like 10 years ago, either if you didn't like your local sports columnist, too bad. That's the only person there is to listen. That's the only person there is to read. Now there's so many more voices and so many new places to go now, which to me is only good for the sports fan.
Interesting. I mean, I'm wondering though, if you can't replace your sports columnist, I mean, can you replace your sports bloggers?
Of course you can.
Can you be replaced? I mean, maybe that's why you hesitate to call it a movement, because would you consider yourself a leader?
I'm sure I will be replaced. Without question. This is the way the web works. Inevitably, the web eats its own. Typically speaking, 7 years ago, Bill Simmons from ESPN was the coolest, hippest, freshest guy out there. And now I don't agree with the sentiment, but there are sports blogs. The general thing among a lot of sports blogs is that he's somehow like lost his edge and become part of the establishment or so on. This will inevitably happen to me. This will inevitably happen to the next thing. To me, the best thing about it, a lot of people worry about sports blogs going corporate or like Yahoo hiring sports bloggers full time. I never worry about a lack of independent sports bloggers. As long as someone has a voice and has something they have to say, they'll go ahead and do it, whether someone's paying them or not. And the nice thing about it is the good ones, the best thing about sports blogs I've learned since doing the site is that the ones that are good get readership. Like, there is a meritocracy to it, which is actually pretty exciting to watch.
But I'm wondering if you can actually maintain this meritocracy with Deadspin, because I know that Deadspin is run by Gawker Media, and you are beholden to page views. I mean, unless you have some sort of separate deal going on with Denton, I don't know.
I have the advantage of not. I don't personally get paid. Like, the new page system they have, I'm the editor of the site, so I don't have to worry about that. That's more for the writers.
But your contributors have to worry about this.
I suppose, but, like, frankly, it's nice because no one really notices. Like, the nice thing about working with Gawker is that, like, they literally have no idea what I do on Deadspin. In a way, I'm a little bit of a hark back to an earlier time of Gawker Media, back when it was, like, the idea was, like, hey, let's take this established thing, whether it's politics or Hollywood or sports, and put a new spin on it. And I think Gawker's changed a lot. It's amazing. I've been a Gawker for almost 3 years, and I'm the second longest editorial employee, which to me, my father, who's worked the same job for 30 years, thinks it's crazy. But out here, it's like, wow, you ran a blog for 3 years. That's amazing.
Yeah, that is 30 years.
It's
some sort of dog years.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm waiting for my gold watch. And, but I do have a little bit of advantage in that. The traffic has always grown on the site, and so I'm sure I always joke that if I would ever leave Deadspin, they would replace me by like five editors that would put up everything would be about who Tom Brady's dating and would have pictures of women in bikinis on it, and I think that's probably true. And they get three times as much traffic as I get right now, so I think I do have a little bit of an advantage in that they don't really know a lot about sports. My favorite Nick Denton story is the time that he sent me an instant message. He famously communicates mostly through instant messages, and he's maybe given me advice on the site maybe three times since I've started, and he said, well, I just wanted to check, is the March Madness over? And I was like, well, Nick, it's June. So yes, it is over. And so because I have a little bit of advantage, sure, of course, it's not an art project. I understand, like, you know, we're not a non-for-profit place, but certainly, like, I never know. To me, having worked in journalism, not only in the past but now, I've never had more of a separation of church and state than I've had at Deadspin. I have no idea what the ads are until they show up on the site. I've never been asked to write some sort of editorial. That happens I've worked at plenty of magazines where all of a sudden, hey, can you contribute this piece to our advertising supplement or so on? I've never had to do anything like that at Gawker, and I'm pretty lucky that way.
Going to this issue you alluded to earlier about the sports fan and how the sports industry looks at the sports fan, you have a section in this book where you remark upon commercials, the Coors Light commercial in particular, and the me and the beer motif, in which you sort of say, hey, well, this is how the sports industry views you. But an argument can also be made that, well, the advertising seems to be working. The beer revenues are tied into this sports just perfectly fine. So, I'm wondering, what do sports fans do under such a predicament? Do they just storm NFL headquarters with pitchforks and demand smarter commercials?
No, I think that's generally a mistake that people make when people talk about the idea of, like, fans having a little bit more voice. Everyone always hears it as like, oh, you have to boycott this sport, or you have to not go to the games, or you have to not drink the beer, or you have to go invade Bristol or something. To me, it's not so much that as much as it is the recognizing that, like, the collective voice of the fan is heard so much more than it used to be. If you look at the Giants-Patriots game, not the Super Bowl, but the one at the end of the season, the one that was supposed to only be on the NFL Network, and there was such this loud clamoring of people that were like, please, like, this is ridiculous, let us watch this game, that, like, even John Kerry heard it, for crying out loud. Yeah. I think maybe 5 years ago, if that was a similar situation like that, they would just be like, whatever, too bad, you don't have a choice. And, like, now I think it's easier for fans to mobilize and have that general scream of frustration heard in a lot of ways. To me, it's more of an incremental thing. It's not so much screw it, we're not taking this anymore. And I mean, it's ridiculous to, no sports fan is ever going to say, okay, you know what? No, that's enough. I'm not a sports fan anymore. You hear this every single time there's a strike or some sort of labor issue. Like, oh, I'm not coming back. Oh, steroids have upset me. I'm not coming back. Everybody always comes back because it's entertainment. And to me, that's actually the larger point to it, is anytime someone ever says, oh, well, I'm going to boycott sports, I'm going to protest this or so on, I was like, trust me, there are far more important things in the world to be protesting than whether or not the sports, they treat you bad in the beer commercials.
I don't know if it's a measure of that. I guess my question is if sports fans inevitably come back, then what would be the point of raising this particular issue if it's going to be forgotten, if they're going to have more, you know, course-like
commercials? It's not so much forgotten as much as it is that recognizing that, like, you know, those things are heard now. Like the sports industry is not so much in a vacuum as much as it used to be, or an echo chamber where everyone's just kind of talking to themselves, and fans are this weird outside thing that, like, oh, I hope they're liking this or so on. Oh, I guess the ratings are good. I guess we're doing fine. Now there's actually a call out for that. I remember during the NCAA tournament, not the last one, but the one before, there were these Applebee commercials that had these tremendously irritating Applebee's commercials that were played at every commercial break of the NCAA tournament. And just like they had these, I think the guys now do the free credit report ads, so on. These two banjoing wacky white rapper guys, and it was just like the most irritating ad in the world. They actually stopped running those ads after the first weekend, even though they had made a whole deal. Applebee's realizing this is actually hurting our brand. How did they know that? Not because they got a bunch of angry letters to the company. It's because you could see it. You could see it on blogs. You could see the widespread reaction of, please stop doing this. And they did react. So certainly I think I react a little stronger to those beer ads than maybe the average fan does.
But there is no shortage of beer ads. I mean, every time I turn on a game, I'm going to see a beer ad along these lines.
To me, the question is more of a matter of, like, pointing out to fans, like, hey, I don't know if you guys have noticed or not. It was funny, but they think you're morons. And I think I remember ESPN Magazine, which I actually like, ESPN Magazine, they actually did they had a cover story about fans. And before I even saw the cover, I was like, you know what, I guarantee you, this is going to have a shirtless guy. It's going to have some guy drinking a beer. It's going to have one guy paint his chest painted. And of course, that's exactly what it was. And I hang out with sports fans all the time. I've literally never met one of those people. And I think part of the reason that is when you work in sports, the only time you really come into contact with fans are either when they're filling your mailbox with nasty messages how they don't like you, you're listening to sports radio, or you're seeing the guy the camera happens to catch at a game that happens to be screaming on the sidelines. And I think because of that, you get skewed a little bit there. So to me, it's a matter of just kind of pointing these things out to people. Like, look, listen, this is actually, like, this can change, but it's a matter of that, like, recognize this first, I think, is the general idea.
You have a section in this in which you talk about steroids, which we've just alluded to, and you suggest that most sports fans really don't care about steroids. They're happy to accept this. You cite the Scott Rolen incident and the cortisone shot. Yeah. And you write specifically, show me an industry in which the vital players don't try to take every opportunity to give themselves even the slightest competitive edge, and I'll show you an industry that isn't around anymore. But I should point out to you, Mr. Leach, that, yes, well, the Olympics have been around since 1896.
And yeah, and they're completely waning in influence, and nobody trusts that anyone's not. Look at track and field. I guarantee you watch track and field during the next Olympics. Wait a year and a half, and half those guys are going to get busted for steroids. This happens every single time.
They bust them for steroids. I mean, they take away their medals if they're caught with steroids with the Olympics.
Yeah, but that's certainly affecting the public enjoyment of the Olympics, I think, in a ton of ways. I think that, like particularly track and field is a great example of that, or cycling or other things, where people don't even take the sport seriously anymore. And why would they at a certain level? And to me, I think that it's not so much that fans don't care about steroids. It's just, I think everyone would just assume their favorite player not be using steroids. Would just as soon have they? Everyone would love to have this theoretical even playing field where everyone's all playing with the same rules. Everything's fine. I don't think that's actually how people. I think everybody recognizes it's never going to be the case. So at a certain level, you have to hope that your guy isn't doing it. But if he is, you know, at a certain level, held up your end of the bargain is kind of a general way to do it. Is that, like, I think getting back to the idea of working in sports, when you work in sports, steroids is either a story you missed, something that was going on that you knew about, something you were doing, or it's some sort of sin of the past type of thing. Whereas I think, and so basically, if you look and see all the congressional trials and everything that's happening, they're still all kind of fighting stories from like 10 years ago or so on. And I think the average fan has basically just been like, you know, listen, I hope no one's doing steroids, but honestly, I don't take this as seriously as you guys do. So a lot of people call that hypocritical of fans, to be like, oh, well, I want my team to win, but I don't care, and I don't care how they do it, as if it's somehow hypocritical. I think that's actually a far more, much better perspective on the world of sports, of realizing that, you know what, this is not actually life and death, and in a lot of situations. If you look, I think that's why this thing seems, to me, the reason the steroids has kept going on is not because there's been this rapid increase in steroid use, it's because they're still trying to to find stories that they were trying to track down 10 years ago. Yeah. So it becomes this thing that it's what I call in the book the Nancy Grace rule, which is the minute a sports story reaches the cable networks or Nancy Grace, it becomes no fun for actual sports fans to talk about. And I think that steroids is a great example of that. Steroids is the type of thing that like casual fans get fired up about, but people that actually watch the sports on a regular basis have kind of come to terms with a little bit.
Well, the Olympics still lives on. I mean, it's still, yeah, but so I mean, there's no sign of dying. I mean, isn't there something noble in this? I know you have issues with the Olympics.
Oh, I would definitely disagree with the notion that the Olympics show no sign of waning. I think clearly the ratings are down every year. The Olympics, there's something kind of archaic about the Olympics. The idea, first off, that like they're almost literally archaic because by the time they're actually on programming here in the United States, we all have to pretend that we don't have the internet and can't actually see what happened all that day. It's almost highlight packages. And the thing I talk about the Olympics in the book is actually kind of a joking thing about the idea of how it's almost un-American to root for the United States in the Olympics because we, as a country, tend to love underdogs, but for some reason in the Olympics, we're never the underdog. So like we should almost be happy for other countries. We'll go ahead and have our superior economic model, I guess up until recently, and they can have their luge.
But going back to this quote I just read you about it being an industry that you need to have a competitive edge, well, it seems to me, okay, it may be a quaint or archaic notion, the Olympics, but I have to say it's a rather noble endeavor to actually try to champion physical prowess without performance-enhancing drugs. I mean, certainly that's something.
I agree,
that,
but do we honestly live in that planet? I mean, honestly, can we honestly...
I think so, as long as the Olympics go on, I think so.
That we actually have this like theoretical even playing field?
Well, in relation to the Olympics, certainly not in relation to industry, and that's why I want to ask you about industry. Do you think that sports are just...
Also, it's not like the Olympics is like this like non-for-profit little exercise. I mean, it's like this massive...
Of course, endorsements and all that. Yeah,
exactly. So, I mean, like, I think like painting the Olympics as some sort of like... old school, pure kind of, yes, this is what we imagined athletics, and so that's frankly part of the kind of the hype machine of what they do about the Olympics. They all pretend that like these are not like, first off, they're not even amateur athletes anymore. So that kind of thing that everybody loved about the Olympics.
Well, the Dream Team is a joke.
Is that true? Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, it's not just the basketball players aren't amateurs. Yeah. Again, there are no amateurs anymore. Except for the people that actually can't get paid for doing the skeet shooting or whatever they do in one of the sports. But so to me, I think that the holding the Olympics out as some sort of separate, this is actually the world all coming together. I'll take the World Cup over the Olympics in that
regard. Simultaneously, you're dealing with probably infinitely more hype with a professional industry-driven sports league of some sort.
Yeah, like the Olympics. Professional-driven sports league,
like
the Olympics.
But if I had to choose between at least the Olympics, what I'm pointing out here is that at least the Olympics is trying to have some kind of...
They've certainly been better about the testing and of drugs and so on. They certainly have been, but that's hardly foolproof either. And the fact is you're always going to be... no matter what your testing system, you're always going to be one step behind the people that are trying to cheat you. Now, on one hand, you can be outraged by this, be like, I can't believe this. I'm no longer going to watch these games because I don't believe any of these people. Or you can take the other hand, which I think is what the majority of people do, not just in the Olympics and all sports, but they're like, you know, I hope no one's juicing. I just assume. But you know what? I'm not actually going to stop watching this because of that. And I think that's actually the better way to put that is the idea that, like, there's two reactions. You either get furious, like, how do we fix this problem? Or you're like, listen, there are larger problems in the world to fix than doping in the Olympics or doping in baseball. Let's just enjoy the games for what they are and then go back to our lives.
We had mentioned Chuck Klosterman earlier, and you have a point where you watch ESPN for 24 hours straight, and which is, you allude, of course, to Klosterman's exercise.
Yeah, and Hugh Gallagher's, Rolling Stone.
MTV. Yeah, I remember that. And
that's a great piece, by the way. I'm really good friends with his sister. She's one of the Black Table
people.
Interesting. Yeah.
But I'm wondering what purpose this actually serves. Is it sort of a stunt writing, or did you want to kind of align yourself? Do you fancy yourself a sort of Chuck Klosterman figure of sports?
I think Chuck Klosterman can be his own Chuck Klosterman figure of sports. He writes about sports much more eloquently than I do. But I do think that, it started out as a stunt. I thought it'd be kind of a fun way to wrap up the book and kind of see what I learned. But one of the things I kind of understood after watching it for that long is just how much ESPN really does control the conversation in sports. Like at a certain level, like they kind of decide at the beginning of the day, here are the three stories that we're talking about today. And that is what is hammered home on every channel. It was very amusing to watch John Clayton, the NFL, the pretty talented NFL reporter for ESPN, essentially talk about the exact same story 15 different times on 4 different channels. And it's funny because there's that old annoying joke that media people get very irritated by, that like when people just love to like blanketly say, oh, the media and so on, the media decide who's going to win, as if like the media all meets in the morning and says, okay, here's what we're going to do today, guys. I think media people are justifiably annoyed by that. But ESPN actually is like that, because they actually do have meetings and say, here's what we're going to do today. And they become so powerful. And again, they're not an art project. They have a right to go ahead and try to become as powerful as possible. But because of that, they really can drive the conversation in so many ways that they basically decide. I think the three stories that day were, it was right before the Michael Vick dogfighting thing really hit. Randy Moss will mesh with the Patriots one of the stories I don't quite remember what it was, but like those three stories were the three stories all day. And it's like every single time I ever turned on one of those channels, that was like it was honing down the message, and that's fine and everything, but like and it's impressive, frankly, they can fill up 5, 6, 7 channels of 24-hour programming. But at a certain level, you realize that in microcosm, it is a kind of an example of what ESPN does, where they really just kind of like, okay, what we say is news is news.
I wanted to actually ask you about this boast of yours of 6 photos of Ben Roethlisberger, you know, where you have, you know, him completely shit-faced, essentially.
And having
you
fun.
You point out this is kind of in defiance of his golden boy image. But I have to ask you, you know, why should anybody be concerned with what he does in his personal life? Isn't this kind of promulgating gossip in some manner?
Certainly, in a certain way, I think that I don't know anyone that looked at those photos and were like, you know what, I always liked Ben Roethlisberger before now, but now I just can't cheer for this guy. To me, the people that get upset about those photos, and this is actually, we've seen this, we had these famous Kyle Orton photos on the site, and he actually found them very amusing. He's like, I didn't drive home afterwards, I wasn't the day before a game, I'm a guy, what am I going to do? And I think that, frankly, most athletes generally understand that people that actually get upset about photos like that are the people that have money to be made off the athletes, off this kind of idea that, like, well, because Ben Roethlisberger can throw touchdowns, he is therefore this perfect human being and I should drink his sports beverage. And to me, I think that's the larger issue. And, yeah, you can say, well, the off-field stuff shouldn't matter and so on. I think that's kind of silly, frankly, in a lot of ways, because, like, first off, these are paid entertainers. Like, I don't think anyone ever says, well, let's let Tom Cruise's movies speak for themselves. I mean, I suppose some, like, hardcore cinema folk would do that, but I think that would be in the vast minority. And I think
I would fall into that vast
minority. Okay, well, good, good.
But also I would fall into that minority in relation to Roethlisberger, because, I mean, I don't care if the guy fucks goats. I mean, I want to see him, how he plays.
I don't think there's anyone that saw those photos that would disagree with that, with that point. That's why I think that those photos... Like, the photos are there because they're kind of funny and they're kind of humanizing. Like, it's not like there's... I really can't imagine a single person... We certainly didn't see any of these reactions when I had them on the site. Yeah. Anyone being like, oh, you know, I don't like that guy anymore. Here I was, thought he was this perfect human being, but instead he's this 23-year-old, rich, really famous guy that's on top of the world and having a good time. I hate him now. Like, you didn't see anybody having that reaction at all, and why would they? To me, like, there is something kind of humanizing about the idea that, like, yeah, he's this 23-year-old guy, he's having a good time because he's been Roethlisberger, he should be having fun. And so to me, I find that the photos speak of something a little bit more truthful than what me seeing Ben Roethlisberger, you know, advertising Gatorade.
Yeah.
So
I'm wondering, though, if you contribute to this notion of the football player or the athlete as image by dwelling upon how he looks in these photos. I mean, shouldn't it be about the game and about
the sports?
Well,
I think it always will be. If Ben Roethlisberger was a terrible quarterback, no one would care about those photos. Of course it's about the game. But realize that these are paid entertainers. That is, no matter what, whether they're playing or whether you're seeing them interviewed, they're a paid entertainer. Chris Berman's a paid entertainer. I'm a paid entertainer. Like, I think it's ridiculous to try to pretend that, like, oh, but all that really matters is on the field. Well, fine. Well, then don't. I don't want to see your advertisements anymore. If that's really the way it is, then don't try to sell me anything. Don't try to pretend that, like, you have some sort of influence other than being a football player.
If you are a paid entertainer, well, what makes you different from the media people who you write about who view sports as a job? I mean, as you allude to many times in this book, you point out that, well, you know, you're essentially a paid typist or a paid blogger or a paid whatnot.
Yes.
So I must ask, well, what makes you sort of keep things fresh?
The main thing for me, the way certainly I fall into the same traps as everybody else does. I certainly put myself not as this paragon of virtue as opposed to the corrupt sports industrial complex. But certainly the best I can do is try to, I don't have any interest in going in a press box. To me, that's not interesting. To me, that takes the fun out of sports. I don't want to take free stuff or get free press box food or be able to take these trips and so on. To me, it's a lot more the way that, and it's a challenge, of course. The site's gotten larger. You have to be definitely a little bit more vigilant about it. But certainly, like, I've no interest in doing that, and there'll be in becoming. I actually was rejected that by trying to do this, but having once done the sports writing, the regular traditional sports writing way, and that's fine. Like, I don't think I think it's key to point out that I don't think that these people are people that work in sports are lazy or bad people or anything like that. I just think they're kind of stuck in a system that's dying. And you know, and I, but to call, I'm certainly not calling myself out as the, well, I have all the answers, please listen to me. I'm just saying that, like, the best I can do is try to keep the site fresh and, like, kind of still kind of away from the thing, from the kind of traps I see a lot of mainstream sports media people fall into a lot.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering though, you're just dealing with a different medium then, essentially. You're the same as them, so why go ahead and single them out?
Oh, I don't know if I would. I'm not sure it's necessarily the same as them, but I think that there are things that I do that are the same as them too. But to me, like, you know, it's a matter of recognizing that, like, you know, if you work in sports, what you do is fair game. And that goes for me too. Yeah. Like, that goes for me too. I mean, certainly there are drunk photos of me online too. Unfortunately, nobody cares. Yeah. But I would like to have someone respond to them by being, though, listen, as long as there's a good job in a sports blog, who cares about those drunk photos? And I would like to have that, the Roethlisberger effect.
You have a lengthy digression in which you go and describe the Yankees Stadium problem of having to go ahead and contend with all this. But I should again point out that I actually looked out of curiosity because I was like, well, how many people really are still attending sports? And, people are still going to ball games.
The average
figure is like 70%. I think, like, the Kansas City Royals is the lowest, and that's like 60%.
Attendance is up across the board. Why wouldn't it be?
So why then do you think, I mean, you know, again, describing something like this, describing the hell of going to, you know, see the Yankees play, I mean, what does this do to contribute to, I don't know if it does anything to make fans stop going to these ball games, you know what I'm saying?
I'm not trying to get anyone to stop going to the game. I'm just pointing out that anyone that's gone to Yankee Stadium has certainly had the exact same experience I've had in that book. I don't think there's something at the end that says, so let's not go to games anymore, everyone. Like, that's certainly not the point of that essay to any stretch of the imagination. The essay is to point out those things that happen to you when you go to Yankee Stadium. We've all had that experience. Anyone that's been to Yankee Stadium has had that happen. Yeah. That's what it's about. Certainly it's not that some advocacy to never go to baseball games again.
But I guess I'm wondering this as well as the commercials. It's like, well, how do you fight a system? Are you not fighting a system? Are you essentially just pointing out observations that could very well be abandoned? I mean, it's the system's going to still march on if there is no sort of, I guess, you know, major action to kind of at least,
but see,
you know,
that's my point, though. There is the observational quality of the book. I'm certainly not interested in leading a revolution, but I'm not sure it's a revolution type thing anyway. To me, the larger point is that, like, there are incremental changes and there are little things. In the past, literally, people that worked in sports never heard what fans had to say unless they happened to turn on talk radio and whatever boobs listen to talk radio anymore. So, but to me, like, now you can actually hear that. You can actually hear reasoned commentary on, like, hey, listen, as a fan, I don't like going to Yankee Stadium, and here's some of the reasons why. To me, it's a matter of being aware. No, it's not a matter of, like, storming the gates and saying, okay, down with everything you pigs do. But it is a matter of people being heard, and the fact that some guy can put a YouTube thing of him and his buddy commenting while playing Madden, someone at EA Sports seeing that, recognizing that it's very, very funny, and making it part of their national ad campaign the next year, that's a good thing. Like, that's a good thing. That's actually a fan-driven thing that's legitimately funny and legitimately well done, transferring over to the mainstream. It's never been a matter of selling out. It's a matter of, like, these actual, like, kind of real actual things being seen on a wider scale.
I don't know about that, because to me that seems like you're co-opting the fan. You're actually going ahead and taking this experience, and they're essentially selling the product as opposed to celebrating the fan experience. And I also want to ask, why can't you lead a revolution? There are book revolutions. There are cinematic revolutions.
Well, it's not that good.
Well, no. I mean, but why not? Why can't fans take a stand and say, you know what, enough of this bullshit. I can't smoke my cigarette. I can't drink my beer except standing in line, you know, right, paying $9 for a beer, which is obscene. I'm sorry. You know? You know? I mean, why can't fans demand better? Why can't they reject this system?
They certainly can, but I mean, at a certain level, I think that's an example of fans not taking everything as seriously as I think people expect them to. Whenever people talk about what fans revolt, they always act as if, like, they're going to boycott and stop going to games. This is diversion. This is entertainment. Sure, I could boycott going to movies because I'm sick of seeing. I'm really upset that that Vantage Point was number one movie this week, so therefore I'm not going to movies anymore. But I don't think that's really the point. The point is like being able to recognize that like is spending your dollar wisely and making your voice heard in a lot of ways. But certainly, I think any attempts, inevitably there'll be a radio station every year in Baltimore or Detroit or so on that will try to do a fan walkout or a fan boycott or so on. And they're just media stunts. They're media stunts. To me, the better way to do it is actually to almost kind of infiltrate it slowly and kind of make changes from within a little bit.
But have you seen any changes from within through Deadspin? I mean, have there actually been sizable currents against this kind of sports industrial complex?
Certainly, I can't take full credit for them myself, but you do see changes now. The idea that you look at about a year and a half ago, a great example of this. About a year and a half ago, Michael Irvin, the then broadcaster for ESPN, made this comment about Tony Romo, the quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys, saying he's a white guy, and it's saying because Tony Romo is so quick, his great grandmother must have rolled around with a slave or something. Like this very incendiary, crazy comment on a radio station. He made it on a radio station and 5 years ago, nobody hears that. Everyone listens to it is like, oh, that was kind of weird, and then just kind of like shuffles under. What happened? That was heard. It was blogged about repeatedly, and eventually ESPN had to make an apology on it. There's an accountability now. I think that it takes a couple days, but eventually it becomes that you can't ignore it. Look at the Dana Jacobson thing that happened at ESPN. Yeah. The idea, that's a great example of something that they had. I'm sure ESPN would have loved for that to just gone away. And 5 years ago, that goes away. They never have to deal with it. They never have to comment on it. Now there actually is accountability there, and I think that's important. I think it's good not just for the sports fan, but probably actually for ESPN.
Speaking of accountability, I want to bring up the 49ers video, the infamous one that was shepherded by.
Yeah.
Kirk Reynolds.
Yeah.
I was in San Francisco at the time, but you observed that he realized he was dealing with alpha males with little desire for an opening of their worldview, so he made the video as crude as possible. Now, I'm curious about this because, you know, this is the 21st century. Why should athletes be held to a different standard in terms of civilized discourse, because there's a lot of really terrible things in this video.
Oh, I think they should, but I don't think it's Kirk Reynolds' job as PR head of the 49ers to try to chain to his job is to minimize media blowups. His job is to not have Garrison Hurst.
Well, he
say
certainly
these
did a shitty job.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, he did.
You know,
but
I mean,
if the thing is, if that hadn't leaked, he did a great job. The problem was that it leaked. But and I'm not saying like that there's anything in that video that's justifiable, except for you have to realize in the context that it's in. You have to like, yes, I agree. Athletes should not be held to a different standard, but that's not Kirk Reynolds' job. Kirk Reynolds' job is to make it so, and what he was trying to do was actually a good thing. He was trying to be like, okay, I'm appealing to you on your level. Gay people are not horrible people. You don't have to actually say these things. Try to be careful when you're doing this. He was trying to do it, but he was doing it on a pretty crude level. But like, you realize that like,
but he's resorting to, I mean, you can't have it both ways, Will. I mean, he's resorting to this kind of stereotypical.
So what do you
portrayal.
Want him to do? Do you want him to go in and be like, okay, everyone, here's our sensitivity training exercise? They're of course going to tune in.
No, you respond to that kind of bullshit by just chewing them out, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure the director of media relations has a lot of effect, has a lot of ability to chew out large football players.
You talk to the coach and say, look, your guy is.
But the coach doesn't want to deal with this stuff.
Well, he has to. It's the team. It's just part of the business.
Come on. I mean, like his job, like you have to realize how low on the totem pole and the team concept the director of media relations is. All he can possibly do in that situation is say, how can we make this not a problem in the future? Fine, I'll make this. Like, Kirk Reynolds is a smart guy. He knows the stuff in their defensive. And it's funny because the actual takeaway from each of those things, as crude as they are, is actually kind of a positive message for these guys. Yeah, you have to dig through everything to get there, but he's actually trying to do that. I think trying to say that he's supposed to do some sort of. Like, you make it sound like much more like the military than it actually is, like, as if he could actually go in and say, okay, everybody, listen up. Stop doing this, because we're all sensitive here. It's a football locker room, for crying out loud. You're lucky you got them to watch the video in the first place.
But if he were to go to the top, and he were basically to say to coaches, managers, and say, look, you are really fucking up the 49ers' image. If you go ahead and have these guys mouth off, it's going to be terrible for the team.
And the coach is going to say, ugh, leave me alone, I'm watching film. I mean, it's exactly what he's going to do. You have to realize that the way these things are, the coach doesn't they don't have time to deal with that stuff. Being a football coach, you stay up till 4 o'clock in the morning studying film and get up at six.
So you fight fire with fire? That's your answer with this?
I think that was his. I think it was pretty justifiable, frankly. I think it's very easy for us to sit back now and be like, boy, wait, there's some very offensive stuff in that video. And I think, you know, I mean, I certainly, once it came out, I think he probably had to be fired. But certainly, like, it's easy for us to sit back and say, wow, yeah, that's terrible. He should have never done something like that. But we're not in that locker room. We're not actually trying to evoke some sort of change on that kind of level. I'm not saying the players are excusable for it. I'm not saying he's excusable for it. But that's certainly the context.
But you are defending him, and you are calling him a smart guy, and you are sort of saying, well, basically he did the right thing under the circumstances.
He was trying, man. I'm sorry. Yeah, I agree. I agree. I guarantee you, if he made that video for a grad student program, it's an entirely different looking video. It's a guy trying to appeal to his audience. That's his job. His job is not to make widespread social change.
But that's also assuming that all of these athletes are dumb. Do you really think that? I mean, they don't have the ability to sort of register what's going on when they spout off their mouth like this?
Frankly, he had just dealt with the Garrison Hurst situation that put him in this situation in the first place. So certainly you can forgive him for not necessarily having a lot of trust in their ability to handle these situations.
Well, that's just Garrison Hurst.
Yeah, but come on. I mean, like, or Tim Hardaway, or like the entire, like, or the famous Cordell Stewart story from the book, where he famously, to prove that he wasn't gay, to his teammates, actually said, "Here are pictures of my favorite sexual positions with women." And
who you played tag team football with?
I did.
Now, why the hell did you do that? You knew you were gonna get your ass kicked.
Well, that was actually the funniest part about that was because it was a promotional thing for the Pros versus Joes television program, and it's kind of a fun thing. I batted against John Rocker. I played football against Andre Rison and Cordell Stewart, and we played basketball against Charles Oakley and Charles Smith. And the fun thing about that I found from each of one of those is, even though all three situations, they were vastly superior physical beings than me and could destroy me just on talent and raw brawn alone, they still felt the urge to use trickery. Rocker threw me this wacky curveball when I wasn't expecting it. Andre Rison ran me into a pylon so he could catch the touchdown. And I kind of like that idea that, like, there's such competitiveness of all of these guys that even though they have every possible advantage anyway, they still feel like, okay, I have to win at any means necessary, which I think actually is a little bit of an insight into the mind of an athlete a little bit.
You point early on in the book to the Michael Vick, Ron Mexico thing as a key indicator as to why ESPN is corrupt, why it is...
Corrupt is an overstatement, but I think that...
Well, you pretty much almost say it.
Well, I don't think ESPN is, like, purposely out to ruin sports, or like they're just a bunch of evil people sitting in a room and be like, okay, how can we ruin the experience for the sports fan? And the problem is you know, they're a corporation. I watch ESPN. Every major sports fan watches ESPN. If you're a sports fan who doesn't watch ESPN, you're frankly not much of a sports fan. There's really no major competitor to them in a lot of ways. So because of that, they have us. We're not going anywhere. The hardcore loyal watching ESPN no matter what customer is always going to be there. But they're a corporation. They need to grow. So what happens? Of course, they go after the more casual fan. They build up controversy. They kind of dumb things down a little bit. And I think for those of us that remember the glory days of ESPN, of Keith Olbermann and Dan Patrick and Craig Kilborn, and like just the really funny, very literate, very smart days of past. And I think it's natural when you get away from that and you start going to just, you know, the goal becomes not to enlighten or entertain or to inform. The goal becomes the self-sustaining of the brands.
Why can't you enlighten and entertain at the same time?
I think you can. I just think that becomes not necessarily the goal. The goal is the self-sustaining of the brands. Yeah. Like, I'm sure that they certainly do some enlightening and do some entertaining, but that's not the goal.
The NFL actually banned Ron Mexico jerseys at various games as well.
And so, also, I mean, in addition to the word gay on the back of the jersey, I might have.
Yeah, but I should point also that, this news story was covered by the AP, the Washington Post, generally news outlets that didn't have a direct financial tie to the NFL. So,
agreed.
I mean, is it pretty much, I mean, so it's not entirely a media blackout. It's more of a sort of, you are corruptible because you are beholden to what they say.
Agreed. That's why I singled out the Sports Illustrated and ESPN in there.
But what can be done about that? I mean, is it really blogs? Are they the great sort of salvation for
this? It's not so much blogs, but it's a matter of understanding. I mean, I think blogs are a factor, but I think it's a matter of understanding that, like, you can't hide from news anymore. I find you see this happening a lot with ESPN when they have internal issues like the Dana Jacobson thing or the Chris Berman videos that came out. In the past, the goal, whenever there was an internal issue like that, You could, they, if ESPN didn't cover it, they could actually kind of legitimately hide it. It was amazing to me when I started the site how few people actually knew. That was few hardcore sports fans actually knew about the Ron Mexico thing. Mm-hmm. Because ESPN has such power and such breadth that they actually can kind of ignore things and a lot of sports fans won't know about them. This happened with the Harold Reynolds that I talk about in the book, which is they basically just never gave an issue never gave a reason for him firing, and they just kind of did like they were a mom and pop store over in the corner somewhere. But like to me, now they can't necessarily do that anymore. There's a that you can't hide from news in a lot of ways. It eventually does get out, and I think in the past you might have been able to do that with the Mexico story. I think now, like obviously, like if there's anything that blogs and Deadspin to a lesser extent have been able to change, it's the idea that you can't pretend that no one knows this anymore. You can't ignore something online and hope it's just going to go away. It doesn't work that way anymore.
I want to ask you about a section of the book in which you discuss athletes who thank Jesus and God after a game. You write, they don't thank Jesus for helping them win a game. They thank Jesus for everything. You further suggest they do this because, as you put it, one of the founding principles of Christianity is to spread the gospel of Christ. But I have to actually respond to this because these athletes, they're sitting here putting their mental and emotional energies into this game. And then they come out and they want to go to the locker room and they want to relax. They get a microphone shoved in their face. Is it really sort of fair to suggest that they're proselytizing because they're beat down after?
I think the legitimate ones are. I think that certainly there are those people that just say, I just want to thank God just as like because it sounds good and it's an easy thing to do. But I think
When you've just played four quarters and you've just gotten the shit beaten out of you and you're basically sort of thinking and you're mumbling whatever comes to your mind, which is completely gone.
Yeah, but in a lot of those things, the first thing that comes to their mind is God. It's actually a very spirited defense of that. The example I use is Zach Johnson after the Masters, who famously, after he won the Masters, you know, this underdog, no one expected him to win. He'd beaten Tiger Woods. Everyone couldn't wait to hear what he had to say. And they're all like, Zach, congratulations on your win. How do you feel? He's like, first off, I want to thank God for all of his blessings. And people just like, people were like disappointed, like as if like oh here he goes with that. But that's a legitimate thing. He's a legitimate Christian that not only proselytizing, but like the idea that like God is something to your Christian athletes, like to your Christians. The idea God is not it's not so much you thanking God for liking you more than your competitors as much as it is that like everything I do is through the grace of God. Therefore, I thank Him as my for everything that any good fortune that may happen to come my way.
But I mean, it's just you're going ahead and mocking hardcore Christians, which, you know, I have some sympathies for.
Oh, I certainly don't think I'm mocking hardcore Christians at all. I actually think it's a very big defense of them in a lot of ways. I think it's actually opposite of that.
What I mean is the hardcore Christians who latch upon these sorts of great salvations that come from the lips of these players. And then you juxtapose this in relation to this statement about like how they're intended to essentially proselytize. I don't necessarily think that's the case because, I mean, someone's relationship
Think I'm mocking them at all, frankly. I really don't think that's the point of the essay at all. The point of the essay is to say that you always get nothing riles, a few things rile not just sports fans, but people in general when people like feel like they're being sermoned to. People feel like they're trying to convert someone or there they go thanking God or so on. That's the best way. That's exactly what happened after the Zach Johnson thing is the minute he mentioned God, you can almost see the microphones droop from the media, from the people in the media. But to me, like I think it's a legitimate thing. And sure, there are, of course, as there are in any field, people that kind of enjoy saying they love God, but then like don't actually live their lives that way. But I think in sports, it's a higher percentage, frankly, of people that are very serious Christians that they're actually thanking God for everything. I don't think there's anything mocking there at all, actually, about it.
Okay, fair enough. I wanted to ask you about a few sections in this book pertaining to African Americans. You write, the fact is, race is out there in every aspect of our sporting lives, and often white people's major reference point for other cultures is through sports. You could say that the only colors you notice are the ones on the uniforms, but you'd only be fooling yourself. You also write, pity the rare black sports columnist. Any column that they write about sports that isn't about the role of black players is seen as somehow shirking the issue. Any column that they do is accused of blatantly playing the race card. And they get this from their fellow black columnists, too. But you don't cite any specific examples for this point. I mean, this is a generalization.
Generalization. Oh, I don't think so. I mean, if you ever sat in for anytime you ever see any sort of live chat from Scoop Jackson or Jason Whitlock or along those lines, inevitably, every... race comes up, like they can't talk about anything. The poor guys, they're doing great reporting and they're doing their work and race and everyone's always like, oh, there they go again. And, like that happens. Jamil Hill is a great example of this. She's a wonderful columnist for ESPN. She's one of their new columnists. She's very, very good. And she'll write about something that has absolutely nothing to do with race, whatever. And the comments and the responses to her always bring up race. So to me, that's actually the point of that, is that idea that those examples are plentiful of that happening. Just because I didn't actually put the actual names of the people in there, you find a sports columnist, a black sports columnist, that happens all the time.
Okay, well, fair enough. But you also cite a number of African American sportscasters in this. You point out that Ahmad Rashad is the least militant black man on earth. You observe that Greg Gumbel manages to be more boring and white than his sibling, and then for Stuart Scott, you have him. You write that he's a lazy-eyed ESPN bro dog,
yeah,
noted for his annoying attempts to introduce his particular form of slang to an unwilling audience. So I'm reading this and I'm thinking, is this guy just? You can't have it both ways. I mean, you're either an Oreo sellout, or you are. You know, if you actually.
It's a matter of. I don't think there's any sort of sellout.
But this
there's certainly no implication of that.
You
in
do
there.
Understand why this is a troubling sort of situation to write in the book. I mean, you.
I'm not sure I do. Actually.
Well, no, because you're suggesting that there are one of two alternatives. You're an Oreo sellout, or if you stick to your native vernacular, then you're considered some bro dog.
I think you're looking into. I don't think there's any point actually in the book where I say it's one of these two things at all. Actually, I think it's actually kind of a shame in a lot of ways, which is the real point of those comments about Ahmad Rashad and Greg Gumbel. I think that the real point is that certainly you look at Greg Gumbel, who's a very interesting guy. He's done a lot of very interesting things in life. But when you get into broadcasting, you have to have this like flat kind of it's very interesting this flat kind of tone. It's funny because I always find it amusing that James Brown, the broadcaster for CBS, who's very, very good, he does a lot of great things for the African American community, but there's always this separation from what he does at his job. He always has like, it's always a quieter thing. He's always like, it's almost like he's supposed to, when he wears his broadcasting hat, he's not supposed to be the black guy, but when he goes on and does his activism type things, that's okay. Just don't connect that to the network. You see that in a lot of situations where I think a lot of people don't actually know how many great things James Brown has done for the black community because he goes on television and has to be the bland kind of host guy.
Is this why you included this interview with John Rocker? I mean, you know,
I have to say,
why give this guy further credit? Here you are sort of excoriating athletes and coaches for the way they kind of mumble into microphones, and here we have John Rocker who has this problem.
Oh, yeah, but see, I think that's actually one of the more interesting parts. The Rockers, I think, one of the stronger parts of the book, because it's essentially about that idea of the idea that, like, I don't think anyone would read that section of the book and be like, wow, he really does agree with John Rocker. To me, it's actually, first off, it's a funny interview. And secondly, talking about the idea that, like I find it fascinating that one of the things I talk about is the idea that, like, Rocker... it seems in a way Rocker became like America's racist or America's sports racist in a lot of ways. In a frankly way, a lot of ways he mostly deserved. But in a way, most of the time in life in America, you get a second chance when things happen. You apologize, and maybe you'll get, like Michael Richards will inevitably get a second chance doing something that never happened with Rocker. And my theory that I have in the book is that the reason he never got a second chance was because. You know, the world of race and sports is kind of like people try to pretend that, like, oh, in the locker room everyone's the same color, it kind of rests perilously on this kind of idea, and so therefore I don't think that's actually how humans believe. Every human being, black, white, whatever, has their own little things, has their own little beliefs, and it's funny that like Rocker, everyone, I think there were white people that I think were like, well, I don't have a problem with race because at least I'm not as racist as that guy. And so Rocker became like America's racist in a lot of ways. And so I that was actually the reason I wrote a column about Deadspin. That was the reason I got the interview. And to me, the interview's funny. The interview's funny, one. But two, it's interesting how in a lot of ways that like Rocker, because of those comments, now is a Fox News commentator. And now actually is well known, and almost everyone knows who John Rocker is, even though he really didn't actually play very long. And to me, I think it's telling that, like, almost the Oliver North syndrome, that, like, if you're notorious for something, you can actually parlay it into some sort of larger career. And I think he's got a book coming out, for crying out loud. Yeah. To me, I think that's actually kind of a fascinating thing, is the idea that, like, ultimately, he's probably going to make more money off that interview than he ever would have in the first place.
What's the future of sports writing? I mean, you kind of suggested the days of Red Smith are over. And,
yeah, which is a shame, by the way. Red Smith was great.
Yeah, I know. I like Red Smith, too, which is why I sort of ask. I mean, if is I guess, literate sports writing along those lines pretty much dead?
Oh, I don't think so at all. Look at Roger Angel. Roger Angel does wonderful, wonderful writing every year for The New Yorker. And hey, you know what? That's actually... there are no interviews in that. There's no sitting in the press box and then going and interviewing someone after the game and bringing back the report. He's writing in the format of a blog. He's writing from an impartial observer from the outside, writing in that format. That's wonderful writing. Like I remember when my Cardinals won the World Series in 2006, I got very excited after the initial euphoria. I was like, wow, Roger Angel's baseball column this year is going to be about us. It was like really exciting. It turned out to be, of course, just about the Mets. But to me, that's actually I certainly don't think there's any kind of idea that notion is dead at all. I think what Ranger, you look, there's so much great sports writing out there. Jeff McGregor's doing great stuff, and Will Blythe, and so many like great sports writers that are out there. Sally Jenkins, I don't think that there will always be a market for that. I don't think there's anything that would argue, other than the fact the book is actually not very well written, that there's anything against that idea.
Even with the sports industrial complex that we were talking about before?
Oh, of course. I think there's always room for that. It's a matter of being able to step out. That's why the people that are doing it the best are the people like Roger Angel, people that step outside of it a little bit, or Gary Smith, people that step outside, have that kind of perspective. But yeah, it is hard for your everyday beat writer or daily or columnists along. It's harder now than because to me, I think it's actually another reason I think that's really a really good thing about blogs and sports is that it's a generally kind of raised. Yeah, everyone has to raise their game a little bit. You can't just do the same thing you've been doing for the last 25 years. People have other alternatives now. So I think you either get on that train or you don't. If you don't raise your game because there are more competition for you now, so to me you're gonna fall behind. So to me, I think there's much more potential for even better sports writing in the future.
Well, Will, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Of course, sir.
All right, thanks.
Cool.